All right, so that brings us to our speaker tonight. So would everybody please help me welcome Greg P. from Branford, Connecticut.
Hi, I'm Greg Plakis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I have a home group. It's the Tuttucket Speakers Group. We do meet in Branford, Connecticut on Thursday nights. 8 p.m., so if you're ever in Branford, Connecticut on a Thursday night around 8 p.m., you're more than welcome to join us. We're at the First Congregational Church on the Green. I do have a sponsor. I have the opportunity to be able to sponsor other alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I do have a sobriety date. It's August 15, 2001. So I just want to sort of throw out a disclaimer. I have an ego and it wants to kill me. Just want to let you know that. I'm going to want to sound good. I'm going to want to impress you. I'm going to want to, hear laughs and maybe even try to make you cry. But the reality is probably none of that's going to happen. I'll just get that out of the way first. Today in my life through working these 12 steps and having that spiritual awakening and continuing trying to develop a relationship with God try to help others on a pretty consistent basis, I've come to the realization that I've been seeking, my whole life. I can look back clearly and see that as far back as I can remember, I always felt kind of disconnected. More really than anything, empty, kind of like voided, just like I was lacking something. In the reality, if you looked at my life from the outside, if you knew me as a young kid growing up, and you knew my family and how loving and kind they were. I mean, just like any family, we had our struggles and our problems and our tribulations. But the reality was, I could have probably had Mother Teresa and Gandhi as parents, and I still would have felt this way. But for some strange reason, my internal experience was completely different than my external experience. I grew up in a really nice suburb of New Haven, Connecticut, a town called Orange, upper middle class, lived in a really big house with a couple acre yard, had lots of toys growing up, rode dirt bikes, had a ton of friends, was pretty athletic. As a younger kid, I excelled a little bit more as I got older, and joined different teams that traveled and stuff. I didn't stand out as much as I did when I was younger. But locally in my own town, I was, captain of a lot of teams. My room was full of trophies and plaques and ribbons and certificates. Always had a real nice pretty-looking girlfriend when I started actually seeing that girls were attractive. I never really needed of anything, as a kid growing up. My family provided me with everything that I needed, and trust me, I got everything that I wanted. I was definitely a spoiled kid, growing up. But like I said, for whatever reason, it just never felt like it was enough. I could have had, the brand new Jordans when they came out, but, I needed the Bo Jacksons. I could have had the Shaquille O'Neal pumps, but I needed the Adidas Sambas. I just got a brand new Boston Red Sox hat, and, I needed the other Boston Red Sox hat. It was just always just sort of one thing after another. It was like I was never satisfied. And today I can see that there was this need, this search for something. And today I truly believe that it wasn't always completely like that. But as far back as I can remember, from my own perspective, I can see that I was seeking. But why I say that is, I don't have any kids, but I have a younger brother, and, my family really likes to make babies. So there's always a lot of little kids around me, different holidays and events and birthdays and parties and stuff. And I tell you folks, this experience I have when I hold a little kid in my arms, it's just something I really, truly can't put into words. The best way I can describe it to people like us is like taking a handful of Valium. I just feel like, whoa, I just feel at such ease and peace. I look into that little baby's eyes and they kind of twinkle and sparkle a little bit, and that fresh skin and that just like smile that lights up a room. And I think to myself, like, there's got to be like no fear, unnatural fear going on in this baby's experience right now in this moment. Like, they're not worried about it. They could have like you know, crap in their diaper. And they're like, they're not caring. They don't care that it smells or, you know, is this person judging me or, you know, what do they think about me or, you know, like someone needs to really change this. They're like, they're loving. I mean, you can give a little baby a ball and they would just be amazed for hours. I mean, they're just so in the moment. You know, I truly believe like we're all born in this world with this spiritual awakening, this spiritual awareness, just completely and absolutely in the moment and in touch with our Creator. And somewhere along the line, we lose sight of that. You know, I don't know where or when or why or how, you know, but it seems like these just like bricks, these blocks sort of build up through the years. And these fears did start to creep into my life as a young kid. You know, I mean, by the time I was 15 years old, I just felt so tired, just terrified on a regular basis, tired. You know, my biggest fears are what you thought about me. You know, things that I've collected and accumulated over the years that one day I was going to lose them, even people. You know, were like this possession of mine. And things that I didn't have that I saw others have that I thought I really, really needed. And if I didn't get that, I wasn't going to be good enough or whatever it may be. And these were the fears that constantly drove me. And for a person to be dominated by those types of fears at such a young age and so intense, I mean, there was only one place for me to go, and that was inward. So as far back as I can remember, I was just so full of fear and so driven by self. You know? So I can see today, to some degree, why I felt so disconnected, so empty, and so lost. And, you know, I felt this hole the size of Texas inside of me, and I was always seeking, you know. Today I know what I was seeking for, but back then I didn't, you know. And there were things that I found along the way that kind of filled that for a little bit. You know, sports, as I mentioned, you know, I excelled a little bit in sports. But like any good alcoholic, I mean, I find something that makes me feel good. And what I mean by makes me feel good is it took away that hurt. That's what I mean. You know, that emptiness went away. That pain went away, that uncomfortability, the anxiety, the racing thoughts. I mean, just feeling like I want to crawl outside of my skin. But I can't tell anyone how I'm feeling, or I can't give you any sort of idea or perception. So I have to, on a regular basis, sort of like live this way in this path that I can present to you this sort of image of who I am and how I feel and what I think. But in the reality is, inside my head, it's a completely different story. So by the time I'm 15 years old, I feel tired. I feel tired of trying to live this certain way on the outside, but feeling a certain way on the inside and having no release, having no solution to that. So I can see how young people at 13, 14, 15 years old want to take their own life. You know? And, you know, to me, there is no place worse than feeling alone in a world full of people. I mean, it's one thing if I was like locked up and I was in like some sort of solitary confinement for 15 years of my life. You know, I would have a reason to feel alone. It would make sense in my own head. But to wake up on a daily basis and to walk outside in a world full of people, people that love me, you know, people that were my own blood, my family, and I could still be in their own, in their house, our house, and feel like an outsider and feeling like I don't belong, feeling alone. And, you know, I don't wish that upon anyone. It's the worst feeling in the world, you know. So at 15 years old, you know, by chance, I found, you know, myself in my aunt's house in the Westville section of New Haven. I remember the night pretty clearly. There was a Mike Tyson fight on that night, and my cousin had this thing called, like, the box. So, like, got all this free cable, the black box. You had the black box? And, so, you know, we told my mom we're going to go over to my cousin Mark's house and we're going to watch the fight. And, you know, he had some beers in his fridge and he had some roaches in his, you know, his ashtray. And for the first time, me and two buddies, you know, tried alcohol and, you know, smoked some weed for the first time. And I'll tell you folks, it was like for 15 years, I didn't realize how much I was suffering until I stopped suffering that night. I mean, I tell you, man, I there's no way that I can put it into words, but I have an idea that probably at least 90% of you out here tonight, unless you have nothing else to do on a Monday night, have an idea what I'm talking about. You know, like from day one, it's clear that alcohol and drugs were never my problem. For 15 years, I experienced what my problem was, and that was sobriety. Sober. I just didn't know how to live life. You know, disconnected. You know? My selfishness and self-centeredness driven by an enormous amount of fear. And at 15 years old, I found booze and I found pot, and it was like, wow. Like, consciously or unconsciously, I'm like, I want to feel like this as much as possible. You know, and I tried my best, but imagine how hard it was for a 15-year-old kid. I'm 35 years old. Could you imagine what I looked like at 15? I looked like I was like 8. You know, so you imagine this like 15-year-old kid that looks like he's 8 standing outside of like liquor stores trying to get people to like buy booze for him. It was not happening. You know, so I ended up getting connected to some people that would actually, like, in this time, you know, they still had, like, pagers. So I'd actually call, you know, this number, beep, 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 put in my number, and, like, people would actually come to my house and drop stuff off for me. So it was a lot easier. It was more accessible for me to find drugs than it was alcohol as a young kid. But throughout my whole experience, and I didn't drink or use really for that long, but throughout my experience, you know, alcohol really was the staple. I always knew what I was going to get. It was a guarantee. Like, I never got a beat bottle of alcohol. You know what I mean? Like, there's many times that I smoked some sheetrock. But I never, like, got sold some, like, bunk alcohol. I mean, it was always, like, available. It was consistent. And, man, I can remember that first night drinking. It was like I came alive. It was like my coming to story. I mean, it just, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And, I mean, I just felt this, like, warm throat go through my body. And I can just feel it, like I was experiencing myself for the first time. Like, me. I was experiencing me for the first time, just okay, doing right here, right now, whatever I was doing. I was okay with the two kids I was with. I was okay what we were doing. I was okay that I spilled some stuff on my shirt. I was okay that I was trying to sing a Pink Floyd song that I had no idea what the lyrics were. But I was like having a blast. My friend's freaking out on the couch, like he's having flashbacks and different things. And my friend's trying to beat him because he thinks my aunt's going to come up and, you know, we're going to get busted. But to me, it was like, it didn't matter. Like, I'm like, wow, this is amazing, you know? So for the next 4 years, you know, I sought that experience. You know, I was a seeker as far back as I can remember. And that was my solution. And that's now what I sought. You know, like I was getting into a little bit before, I mean, up to that point, you know, I think what sort of kept me alive and the glue that sort of held me together until I was able to find alcohol, which took me for another 4 years, was sports. Because I tell you, folks, when I would put a helmet on my head and I put some pads on my shoulders and I put this jersey on, like, I felt this unified feeling, like I was with this group of other people that we had this singleness of purpose, and it was to win, you know? And when we were out on that field, you know, I had my part to play in that, you know, and I felt important, and I felt I had this purpose, and I felt I was connected to them. And for 3 hours, like, I was completely outside of myself. For 3 hours, there wasn't the noise that went on in my head. I didn't feel a pit in the bottom of my stomach. But the minute that game would be over, whether we won, lost, or draw, the minute that game would be over and I'd be back into the locker room showering and changing, and I'd get back into my mom's car, it was like back to being Greg. You know, so I played football. I played soccer. I was on the swim team, and I didn't even know how to swim yet. I played track. I did horseback riding. I went to camps. I mean, pretty much. And when I joined the track team, there was like literally no positions left, but I had to be doing something. I couldn't not be doing something. I mean, that was my release, you know? And so the guy was like, well, we have high jump. I'm like, all right, sure, I'll try high jump. I mean, I was the worst, high jumper, you know, but it was my fix, you know? You know, it progressed to the point where eventually I got, and this doesn't make me an alcoholic by any means, but it's just part of my story. I got arrested for possession of narcotics, possession of a weapon, underage drinking, reckless driving, and DWI in two different states, in the state of Massachusetts and the state of Connecticut. Like I said, I'm very fortunate, very blessed with a family that could provide a lot for me. And they got a very, very high price, very good lawyer in New Haven. And all the money that he spent, his legal advice was, should probably go to rehab. So he got me into my first rehab. And, you know, I was 19 years old. And I tell you, folks, I don't know what it was. I really didn't have that much of a desire to, like, be at this place. But I realized, like, this little window of opportunity opened up enough where I could see the truth. And the truth was, I was a 19-year-old white kid from the suburbs of Orange, Connecticut. If I went to jail, I would die. Like, I'm not going to survive in jail. Are you kidding me? Like, I died day one, you know, and plus I don't look good in khaki. It's not happening. And, You know, so I went to this rehab. I was 19 years old, and for the first time in my life, I detoxed, you know, and I've been using substances now and alcohol for 4 years, and didn't realize once you stop after you've been drinking for a period of time and using other things that you actually go through this stuff called withdrawal. You know, some experience in this uncomfortability. I don't know if I'm going to throw up. I don't know if I got diarrhea. I'm like shaking. My legs won't stop. I'm sweating. I'm hot. And then I'm cold. And I'm like feeling okay. And the next thing I know, I feel like I want to jump out of a window. I mean, it was just like a couple days of like back and forth. And finally, things started to sort of settle in. And they moved me on to like this next phase. And I was living in this house with a bunch of guys. And, you know, this guy who was about 45 years old. And, he's telling me a little bit of his life story, and he's telling me about his wife and his kids and his business he owns and, you know, his house and the town he lives in. And I was really familiar with the town that he lived in. And, you know, I stopped him. I'm 19, and, you know, this guy's 45 years old. And I stopped him. I said, I don't get it. I'm like, this doesn't make sense to me. I'm like, I'm either going to go to jail or here. Like, I don't really have much of a choice. Like, you have a wife at home. You have kids. You own a business. You own your own house. Like, what are you doing in this rehab with me? And he kind of chuckled at me, and not in a condescending way at all. And he chuckled at me, and he said, "Kid," he said, "how old are you again?" I said, "I'm 19." He said, "Yeah." He said, "I tried to get sober when I was 20. That was 25 years ago. I've been trying to get sober for more years than you've been on this earth." And he said, "Don't get me wrong. I've had clips of period of sobriety. I mean, I've had 5-6 years. I know how to get sober. The reality is I have no clue how to stay sober." He says, "Getting sober is easy. Staying sober seems to be the hard part for me." That wife, if you didn't interrupt me and let me actually finish the conversation with you, that wife is filing for divorce. Matter of fact, I was kind of getting nervous that I was going to get served today. Kids haven't talked to me in a little bit. Either the bank or she's going to take the house. You know, job, no job. Business is going under. I haven't been there to be able to, you know, take care of it. He's like, "I got nothing, kid. I'm at this point where I'm just completely and absolutely surrendered. And if this is what was suggested to me, then that's why I'm here. I'm just trying to follow some suggestions." And I tell you, folks, like from the longest toenails on my toes to the longest hair on my head, that moment, even to this day, I probably wanted sobriety that day more than I've ever wanted sobriety 35 years of my life. And within 2 hours, I was back in New Haven, Connecticut, getting high. I want it to be sober more than anything in the world. I saw my life right there staring at that guy. And I didn't want that. You know, I mean, sometimes I get goosebumps just thinking about that experience again. And I leave this conversation absolutely convinced that this is what I want. I don't know how I'm going to do it, what I need to do, but this is what I want and I'm going to do it. And I leave that conversation. I lived up on the third floor of this house. And what we would do this week that I've been there at this part of it, as I've detoxed, was probably about a week. And now I've been in this place for about a week, this phase. And we would usually, like, after we do all these groups, we'd, you know, hang out for a little bit. We'd shower. We'd eat together. And then we go out to, like, a 12-step meeting, either in Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. And we usually come back, have a little bit of time to hang out, and then we go to bed, and we sort of start it all over in the morning again. So that's what I was proceeding to do. We had the time where we sort of hung out and stuff, and I was going to go shower, we were going to eat, and then we were going to go out to a meeting. And I had this amazing experience with this guy, and I was convinced with every fiber of my being that this is what I was going to do, and I was going to seek it. I didn't know how or where or why, but this is what I was going to do. And I leave that conversation. I get to about the second floor, and this thought pops in my head. And it's like, come on, Greg. Dude, you're 19. This dude's like 45. He's like older than your dad. Like, you have nothing in common with this guy. You've been here for 2 weeks, dude. Like, 2 weeks. You've been sober for 2 weeks. You have everything you're ever going to know. You are good, man. Just stay away from that really hard stuff. Maybe smoke a little pot, but not right now. I mean, wait a little while. A couple weeks down the road, you'll be okay. You know, we hear a word a lot, and it's called denial. And I believe that we probably do suffer from denial at times in our life. But see, denial is that experience when you know the truth and you deny it, right? If we know the sky is blue and someone was to ask us, what color is the sky? And I said, oh, the sky's red. Knowing that the sky is blue, denying what that truth is. There's another word, and I don't think I was experiencing denial that day. What I was experiencing was called delusion. So you see, delusion is a little bit different than denial. Denial is to know the truth and deny it. Delusion is I can't tell the truth from the false. And that day, It wasn't that I was thinking, this is a really bad idea. I know what exactly was going to happen. That day, that made complete sense to me at that moment. Now, what happened was, is I eventually went back to New Haven as some friends picked me up and brought me back to New Haven, and I ended up getting high. And I tell you, folks, the minute that I got high, it was like I snapped out of the delusion. I was like, what the hell am I doing? But at that point, I'm like, oh, screw it. I'm already high. I might as well enjoy it. And I continued on, you know, very scary, you know. At that moment, I didn't realize what I was suffering from was the obsession of the mind, one of the three parts of this disease. You know, I had no idea until I would eventually sit down with a sponsor and went through the 12 steps. And he shared his experience with me. But more importantly, he really showed me. And, you know, that last little bit of that run was really bad. I mean, I started doing things that I never thought that I would do. I mean, I would do things where I'd wake up in the morning and, you know, I'm scrubbing myself so hard that I would almost get to the point where I would bleed. Because I just felt so disgusted and so ashamed. And I just felt like there was just scum, like just slime all over me from the way that I had to live on the streets of New Haven. You know, prostituting myself and, you know, stealing from my family. And, you know, it just got really, really dark and really, really bad. And the craziest thing is that I always had a place to go. I always had family that would feed me and provide for me and clothe me and give me shelter. But I didn't want it, you know. But yet at the same token, I would wake up in the morning and all I would want was to smash my head up against a rock because I just wanted to die. And the only other thing that would give me any sort of relief would be that next thought, which is like, just get a drink. And at this point, folks, it's not like I was trying to go out and party and have fun. I mean, literally at this point, I'm just doing it to maintain. Like, I just needed to get enough alcohol in my body where I feel like I could function, like I can get out of bed and shower, you know. And not to the point that I was experiencing like DTs or like tremors and stuff like that, but just feeling like I was so paralyzed with fear that if I didn't have something in my system, I couldn't do anything. You know, my family eventually, they found me in this house that I was living in, basically like in this kind of like closet. It was really weird kind of setup. You know, they took me back to New Haven. They put me in a hospital. I stayed in the hospital for a couple of days. And, you know, they put me back into another treatment center. And, you know, the lawyer came to visit me and said, listen, dude, this is not baseball. You don't get three strikes in this game. You're on your second. He says, pretty much if you leave this place, don't even bother coming back. They'll find you. So the state of Massachusetts and the state of Connecticut definitely was my higher power for a couple months. And fear sobered me up. And if there's anyone in here tonight or out here tonight who is sober on the fact of fear, God bless you, because it sucks. It's the most uncomfortable experience. But it did its trick for a little while. And what happened was is in my mind, somehow I came up with this idea that, okay, this is it. If I just get a girlfriend, a pretty one at least, go back to the gym, work out, tan, get some new clothes, get my license back, get back into the Carpenters Union, get my paper signed at this house that I'm living at now, probation off my back, I'll be happy, never going to drink again, I won't go to jail, everything's going to be good. And I almost did that to like a T. I got the pretty girlfriend first. I went to a certain point where I had to pay all these fines. I was able to get my license reinstated. I got a car back. I was a union carpenter up in Boston, Massachusetts for a little bit, Local 33. When I moved back to Connecticut, I got a book in New Haven, so I was a Local 24 member. I started working again. I got this great gig off the bat, was working third shift, so I was getting like time and a half, double time sometimes. So I was making $900,000 a week. You know, I was paying off things. You know, I got a nice wardrobe, I got a gym membership, I was working out pretty regularly, I was tanning like twice a day. I mean, I was looking good, and wasn't feeling so good, but I was looking good. And, you know, I'm a young kid. I'm like 20 at this point, almost 21, and I'm walking into AA meetings, and every person in the room is telling me how lucky I am, and how I got the world by the balls, and I wish I got it at your age, kid, and look at you, you got a great job, and you got a nice car, and, you know, I mean, And I would go back to my sober house room sometimes, and I'm like, damn, these people are right. I do have a pretty good life. Why the hell am I so miserable still? And I would just keep pushing. And I would try to like mask that down. I wouldn't tell anyone any of this stuff. Like this is my whole life experience. So I'm still coming to the meetings, and I'm smiling, and I'm glowing because I'm probably orange. And my teeth are like, and, you know, everything's good, and I'm hanging out. I'm living with sober guys in a sober house, and I'm hanging out with them at coffee shops. I don't even hang out with anyone that drinks or drugs anymore. I mean, like, my life was like, I was going to meetings, 2 meetings a day sometimes. I was getting all my papers signed. I was doing everything that I thought I needed to do, and I got up to about a year sober. I was going to a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous this night as I kind of flip-flopped, and was a meeting close by my sober house, and it was my year. And in Narcotics Anonymous, they give you keychains. And for a year, they gave me a keychain that glows in the dark because they told me I didn't have to glow in the dark anymore. Someone tried to explain that to me, but I still have no idea what the heck that means. And, you know, all these people were like, dude, you got a year sober. This is awesome. This is fantastic. Let's go hang out. We'll get something to eat. We'll go play bowling. We'll, you know, go do something. I'm like, no, I got plans, which in translation meant I need to go home to my empty sober house in the dark and sulk about how miserable my life is. Yeah, I got a lot of plans going on tonight. And that's exactly what I did. I left that meeting and I went home into my sober house, dark, empty sober house, because people were actually out enjoying life. And I went back to the sober house room and I started looking at my life. And I started thinking about all those people that I told you about, how telling me how awesome my life is and how grateful I should be and how lucky I am to have the world by my balls. Not my balls, but the balls. And I really started to think about that a little bit more than I probably should. And I started to question the fact is, not that every single day, but why is more often than not, I'm not happy. And I'm like, what is going on? At this point, I'm almost 22 years old, and I'm not drinking and not drugging for a whole year. I'm going to 2, sometimes 3 meetings a day. I live in a house full of sober people. All I hang out is with sober people. I mean, it just wasn't making any sense to me. And I tell you, folks, if there's a word that can describe how I felt, it was like quicksand. It felt like I was in the middle of quicksand, and I was just sinking, and my thoughts just kept getting darker and darker and darker. And I couldn't see a way out. And I looked at my life, and I tell you, there was like skull and crossbones for whatever reason. That obsession to a degree has been lifted at this point in my life where it's like I didn't even want to go back to drinking. It was like skull and crossbones. It was like the furthest thing from my mind. What I was debating was sobriety, this thing that you're offering me in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been doing one day at a time for 365 days, or death. And for the first time in my life at almost 22 years old, 365 days sober, not drinking, going to meetings on a pretty regular basis. For the first time in my life, I thought about committing suicide. And it's crazy to think back on that night. And it was, I just felt so hopeless. And like I said, I mean, I felt it more than I've ever felt in my life. I felt alone in a world full of people. And I didn't know what to do or how to get out of it. And I thought what the answer was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been doing this Alcoholics Anonymous for a year now. And it's not working. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I got some great temporary relief along the way. I know how to use people the same way a junkie can use a needle. You know, and clothes. And power and money. And jobs and cars. I've been doing it my whole life. And it temporarily fills that hole in the soul. That night, there was nothing that could fill it, and I didn't see a way out. But I'm only standing here today by the grace of God, and I believe God will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. He won't do for me what I can do for myself, but that night, there was nothing else that I can do for myself except pick up a phone, and that's what I did. And how dark my mind was for that little bit of light to come in to give me enough willingness to pick up that phone and to call this guy to tell him exactly how I felt. For the first time in my life, I told another human being, doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman, I told another human being how I felt. I've never done that my whole life. I mean, I would tell different people different things, but to tell this person exactly how I felt, I've never gotten that honest in my life ever. You know? You know, so if there is such thing as a bottom, I hit my bottom that night in sobriety. That was my bottom. Drinking and drugs couldn't even get me to that point, but sobriety did. Untreated sobriety got me to that point. And because like I said, drinking and drugs never was my problem. It was always my solution. You know, so I'm talking to this guy, and let me preface, this guy that I'm talking to was my sponsor, who at the beginning of this year, in order for me to live in this sober house, I had to have a sponsor. And in order for me to not be in jail, I had to follow this sober house rules. So one of the rules of the sober house was get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. And there was this particular guy, I don't know if you have these guys or girls here in Quakertown, but there was like this particular guy that was like, when I first came in, I thought he was like the mayor of AA. You know, he like sponsored every guy and girl, you know, wore a shirt and a tie, he spoke at every meeting and chaired meetings and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I was like, all right, well, I'm not going to get him because everyone gets him. So I'm going to do the next best thing and I'll get like his sponsee. And I got this guy, you know, that he sponsored as my sponsor. And he wanted to do like some crazy stuff with me. And I knew it was a bad choice after he asked me. He's like, yeah, we should meet up. We'll go do some step work. And I was like, whoa, slow down, dude. And so we were going to supposed to meet this one day that I was unaware of until he let me know. And I'm driving down Whaley Avenue in the middle of a snowstorm to go see my girlfriend at Southern Connecticut State University. And I get my phone rings and this dude, Chris, picks up. I pick up and Chris is on the other line. He says, dude, where are you? I'm like, who is this? He's like, oh, this is your sponsor, Chris. I'm like, sponsor? What the hell is a sponsor? I didn't say it out loud, but I'm thinking in my head. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, what's up, man? He's like, yeah, we were supposed to meet at Starbucks. I was like, oh, wow, I totally forgot, man. He's like, yeah, I was nervous. I thought something happened to you. I know it's a really bad snowstorm. I'm like, dude, I'm going to see my girlfriend at Southern. We'll reconnect at some point. 11 months fast forward, I want to kill myself. And the only guy I can think of to call is Chris. And he doesn't hang up the phone. He listens to me. I don't know how he could hear anything that I'm saying because there's snot running out of my nose and there's tears coming out of my eye and I'm just like rubbing my face and I'm a mess and I'm telling him how terrified I am. I'm so scared. I don't know what to do. I'm crazy. I don't know what I need. Like, and he just listens to all of it. And he simply says, Greg, you may just be suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I'm like, dude, have you been listening to me? Like, I haven't drank or drug in a year. What are you talking about? Like, I didn't understand this jargon he was, you know, saying. And he said, Greg, maybe the fact is maybe you can look at this experience and say that you haven't drank or drug in a year, but yet you're still experiencing what you're describing to me. So maybe necessarily the problem isn't the drink or the drug at this point in your life, right? And I'm like, yes, thank you. He says, so then what is? I said, I don't know. He says, well, maybe that's alcoholism. As a matter of fact, maybe alcoholism is what treats your alcoholism, amongst some other things. And so he started breaking it down a little bit more, and he started describing some things with him, with inside of himself and his experience, and it started to somewhat click for me enough where very simply he asked me, he said, listen, I don't know what your problem is, and I don't know what you necessarily really need to do. He says, but I'll tell you what, this is what my problem is, and this is what I do. And if you're interested in that, I'd love to show you. And it was enough. It was enough for me to go over his house. And it was enough for me to sit for a couple hours and for us to talk about the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was enough for me to agree to get on my knees with another man that I had no clue who he was in his apartment and hold his hand and say a prayer. You know, it was enough for me to wait, you know, get up from that prayer and grab a piece of paper from him and start writing my inventory. You know, what he gave me was hope. What he gave me was enough to remove all that stuff that was blocking me, you know, from thinking that I'm different from him. And he took me through these 12 steps, you know. But more importantly, he showed me. He showed me with his actions. You know, I watched him. I watched him when I was at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous from this point on. You know, I watched him and when he would have a new guy or a new girl in the corner of a room and have a book open and pointing out some stuff to him or her. You know, I watched him when I would go to meet him at a coffee shop to go over my 8-step list to go start making amends, where I had to wait in line of two other people who were finishing up doing some stuff with them. And as I'm leaving, someone else is coming in. How he would dedicate a whole day to just meet with people. And every time that I would see him, he would have a new guy with him. And the guy didn't even have a car. He rode around on a bicycle and he took buses. And he would still meet with all these people. He didn't even get paid that much money. He wouldn't even have this great job, but he always had a smile on his face. And he wore the weirdest looking clothes, and he was comfortable with that. And he didn't go to the gym or tan like I did. And I'm like, this guy is like paler than a leprechaun. I mean, like, it didn't make any sense to me that this guy could be happy. He didn't have anything that I had. Except he had the one thing that I never had, and he had peace. And he had a sense of purpose. And he didn't walk like he was very cocky about it. You know? He definitely carried himself in a humble way. You know, we started to go through these 12 steps, and he says, this is about as much as I can do for you, my friend. And he says, at this point on, I mean, the best that we can have is hopefully maybe a great friendship. And he says, I'm always available if you ever need me. But the reality is you need to spend your time going to help other people and building your relationship with God. And you can do that by the principles that I've just laid out to you and showed you through these 12 steps. And that's what I started to do. I started to just go out and try to help people and build on my relationship with God and become less and less self-reliant, more and more God-reliant on a daily basis. And I struggle with that. Trust me, I struggle with that. You know, but I try. I try to be of service, and I try to be of service responsibly. You know, I try to be God-reliant in everything that I do. I mean, the biggest thing for me is really trying to practice these principles in all my affairs. Bring God into every aspect of my life, you know. And I don't want to put God in a box because, I don't know, if I got a 2-foot God, I may have a day of 3 foot of shit. And if I got a 2-foot God and a pile of 3 feet of shit, I'm screwed because I'm going to need at least a 4-foot God. So if I can find my God or put God in a box or label it any which way, you know, I'm going to limit God's power, you know, and I don't ever want to do that. I always want to continuously grow. I never want to think that I got this when it comes to God or AA or whatever it may be. I always want to just stay open, you know. So after I had this conversation with my sponsor, we were at this like roundup thing in Brantford, and I had this new guy with me that I knew, and I brought him back to this treatment center and I dropped him off. As I was leaving, this guy that I've never met before, but obviously he saw me at meetings, and he came up to me, he says, I seen you at that Friday night group. And I said, yeah, I go there. I'm like, shit, what did I do? Did I like flick a cigarette on him or something? Like, I felt like he was going to beat me up. He's like, I need to get a sponsor. Can you sponsor? I was like, yeah, about 20 minutes ago, I can sponsor people. He's like, that's awesome, dude. I was like so excited, like, you know, he was from Afghanistan, so I went and got an, you know, Arabic book, and he's like, I don't know how to read this crap. I was like, oh, shit. But he's like, that was a nice thought. He's like, I like that. I pick him up, and we meet at Dunkin' Donuts, and, you know, I'm sitting down, and, you know, I'm going through some things out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with him, and, you know, folks, it was like the words just were like coming alive, like, it was just making sense. Things were feeling right, you know, and I was getting excited. I was sitting there talking to this guy and feeling this just energy of enthusiasm sort of go through me. And he stops me and he's like, dude, what's going on? I'm like, I have no idea. He's like, am I your first sponsee? I'm like, yes. He's like, you seem like you're having a lot more fun than I am. I'm like, I'm sorry if I am, man, but like, this is amazing. He's like, I wish I was experiencing what you're experiencing. Said, maybe one day you can. And never saw the guy again. When I came back to Connecticut and I got back into the union, it was funny because when I left high school, like this whole thing was like, I just don't do well in classrooms and school. Like I knew I had to do something sort of working with my hands and stuff, and lots of family members in the trades. And so I'm like, all right, I'll get into the union. So of course I joined the union, and as I joined the union, they said, you got to do apprenticeship. So I'm like, all right, I'll do an apprenticeship. I had no idea that it meant that I actually had to go to school. I'm like, how weird is this? I'm looking at my like, you know, things to have for my first day of carpenter's class. I'm like, all right, a hard hat, toolbox, tools, like white overalls. And like, I'm feeling like so weird. I'm like showing up to my first day of school, carpenter school. I got my like toolbox and got my overalls and, you know, my hard hat and my like carpenter's book under my arm. And I'm like, what? How did this happen? Like, I did this so I didn't have to go to school. And we're having like our first day, and this guy comes up from the, you know, it was our like union rep kind of teacher, I guess. And he's just giving us the spiel about the union and stuff. And he's like, all right, we're going to start. He's like, put your books under your desk. Put your hard hats on. Get your toolbox. Let's go out to the classroom. And our classroom, besides this classroom that we were in, was just, you know, like a couple of these. And it had showing us how to, you know, do wood studs and different things. And he's like, all right, lay out all your tools. So I lay out all my tools, as everyone else lays out all our tools. He says, pick up this. We all pick up a hammer. He's like, some of you know what this is, some of you used it, some of you have no clue what this is, and some of you haven't used it, and some of you probably won't be really good at using it anyways, but we're going to go through every single one of these tools. And we did, and we actually had to use every single one of these tools. And the next week, we came back for class. And he said, all right, take your hard hats off, take your toolbox, put it under your chair, put your hard hat on your chair, open up your books. And the first chapter was tools. And the first tool we talked about was hammers. And he says, listen, some of you have probably been carpenters longer than I've been a carpenter. But some of you in this room had no experience prior than last week with any of these tools. It would have been like we were trying to read Chinese if you never had an experience with this. So what I wanted you to do is to have an experience with this first. And then I'm going to have you go back and read about it. Because after you've had an experience, it's going to make sense to you. And that's kind of how like recovery has been for me. It's not about getting in it and studying it and dissecting it and underlining it and word by word and page by page. What my sponsor showed me was how to experience God, how to experience these principles by going out and taking action. And once I had that experience, it made sense to me from here, not so much on an intellectualist point of view. And then I was able to go back to that book and use it as a reference. And I used that book as a tool to be able to help other people. You know, and when I look at that book as a book to show me how to help other people, when I look at these steps and these principles as tools to help other people, they fit right in my heart. When I try to understand them and intellectualize them, it's like it just hurts. It hurts my head. You know, like 14 years later of trying to do this deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way that I understand God today is I don't. And I hope I never try to anymore. You know, but I want to experience him. I want to experience him on a daily basis. You know, if God is the creator of all things and God created me and God created all of us, don't you think he would want to create us with some sort of intellectual understanding of him? Maybe he necessarily doesn't want us to believe in him or understand him or to be able to intellectualize him, but maybe he just truly wants us to be able to experience him on a daily basis. And the best way that I've been able to experience him is by just trying my best to live these spiritual principles. You know, steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, they're not my maintenance steps. They're how I grow on a regular basis. You know, and the 10th step is the step that I probably struggle the most with. You know, there's this story of Michelangelo. And Michelangelo is somewhere in Italy, and it's early in the morning. He's got this slab of marble, big slab of it, and he unveils it, and he's setting up all his tools to, you know, perform the sculpture. And this guy walks by him, and he notices him. He's like, holy crap, you're Michelangelo. He's like, wow, this is amazing. He's like, do you mind if I sit here and watch you? You know, I'm so humbled. I can't believe, you know, I get to experience this. You know, I admire your work. He's like, no, absolutely. You know, so he's doing his thing, and he, you know, starts chipping away, and the guy says, you know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but he's like, I have to ask, how do you have such vision? How can you take something so plain, so ordinary, so dull, and, you know, chisel away at something and make it so beautiful? And Michelangelo kind of chuckles at him. He says, my dear friend, he says, that's not what I do. He says, my job, very simply, is to chip away the things that block you from seeing the beauty that's already inside there. You know, there's nothing for us to attain. You know, yeah, I'm a seeker, and I always felt like there was something I was searching for. But the reality today, when I'm spiritually fit and I'm connected, I realize there are no big deals. And what I truly, truly realize is that there's nothing for me to get. I've always had it. Just like when I looked that little baby in the eyes. It's there. It always was there. Always will be there. There's nothing that can truly ever remove that from me. I mean, I may not be aware of it at times, but there's nothing that can ever separate me from that. It was, it is, and it always will be. You know, that's the beauty of it, you know? You know, so I just try to stay as close to that as possible. That's the bullseye. And a friend of mine told me he told me where the origin of actually sin came from, and it came from the age old sport of archery, to miss the bullseye. That's the closest that I feel that any of us ever truly sin, is when we miss that mark. Is that when I'm living aware of self more than I'm living aware of God. And the closest I've ever come to that is when I'm helping my brothers and sisters. When I'm laying my life down. And I don't mean I'm taking a bullet. What I just very simply mean is as I stop watching Game of Thrones for 16 hours, and I pick up the phone and I go try to help someone who's suffering in the same way that I suffer. I don't ever want to forget that night where I wanted to take my life, that 1 year of sobriety. And how amazing my life is today. And don't get me wrong, I've had struggles and tribulations. I buried my dog on Sunday. I lost my grandmother. I lost my stepfather. I got divorced this year. I went through a bunch of jobs. I've had money. I lost money. But through all that, I've never lost my sense of purpose. That's the one thing that life can never take away from me. Everything else is temporary. But that purpose is, it's always there. I mean, I could be homeless, and I'll still have the ability to sit down with another drunk and share my experience, because it's mine. That's the beautiful thing, It's about a personal experience. I mean, I can get up here tonight and try to describe to you how awesome oranges are and how they taste. And, you may have came here for that single purpose because you've never had an experience with an orange. And I may do a really good job to try to describe to you an orange. And you may leave here like, whoa, that's amazing. That's, you almost can taste it in your mouth and you're visualizing it and you have this intellectual experience with it and you have this faith and you have this belief in it. But the reality is you'll never actually truly have a personal experience with it until you do it. So we can sit here and we can go to meeting after meeting after meeting and hear these stories and hear these experiences and we can gain faith and hope and belief. And those are wonderful things. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't become personal to us, and yes, we all have the same 12 steps that we take, but the reality is it has to be personal. Just if I had an orange and I split it in two and I gave half to Leslie and I ate the other half, we're eating the same orange, but we're going to have completely different experiences because it's going to be personal to us. So each one of us will do this journey. We'll all do these 12 steps, but it has to be personal. And the only way that I'm going to have that personal experience is if I actually take the action. So there's a story I like to close with. It kind of changed some things for me after I read it. And I was going through the internet. So right there, I should tell you it's a believable story because everything on the internet is true. And I came across this reading called The Story of the Five M's. And I don't know if anyone's ever heard it. And for purposes of simplicity, and that I only have 6 minutes left, let's just say the five M's. It could be one W and four M's, but let's just say five M's. And the story goes that all spiritual fellowships, entities, have a story of five M's. And the first M of each one of these stories of any spiritual fellowship is man. That's the first M. That could be Jesus. That could be Buddha. That could be Bill Wilson. It could be Frank Buttman. Each one of these starts with a man. But not necessarily the man that we want to look at. It's the experience that that man has. It's that spiritual experience. And like I said, it could be a woman. But for the purposes of the story, let's just say five M's. And each one of those men has an experience, as Jesus has an experience in Jordan and the Buddha under the tree and Frank Buttman at the cross, and Bill Wilson in that hospital. Each one of those men had an experience. So the story isn't so much about the man, but it's the experience that that man had. And from that experience, they now have a message. They had this experience, the spiritual awakening. Something altered their life, and they want to go share that. It's like, and this may sound crazy, but it's like that first time you tried like something. And for me, I don't know why I'm thinking of this at this moment. It's like the first time I tried ecstasy, I was like, oh my God, I found God. Like, this is amazing. Everyone needs to experience this. I'm going to just drop it in everyone's drink. I'm just going to buy a whole crap load. Everyone needs to feel how I'm feeling right now. Like, this is unbelievably awesome. And when you have that spiritual experience, you can't contain it. Just naturally, you want to share it. You just want to shout it from the rooftops. A lot of us, we're new and we come in and we have that experience and you just want to beat them over the head because they're like, shut up already. All right, we know you had a spiritual experience. Relax. But it's amazing. It really is. It's truly. And so from that man, they have an experience and now they have a message and they're going in and carrying this message and they're sharing this with other people and other people are now having this spiritual experience. And now you have this movement. And Alcoholics Anonymous with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and Bill Dotson and so on and so forth to us here tonight. And Jesus and his disciples and Buddha and Frank Bunkman and his Oxford Group movement. But what happens is from that man and they have the experience, there becomes a message, and from that message becomes a movement. And what happens is now that there's this mass amount of people, there's got to be some sort of traditions and rituals and rites and dogma and guidelines and rules, so to say, right? So what happens is that becomes so loud that you can't hear the message anymore. The movement continues to keep going on. The man is forgotten, not so much the man, but the experience of that man, the spirit, what this whole thing is about, is lost in the machine. And from that machine, it just grinds and grinds and grinds till you show up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to a lonely chairperson dealing a solitary hand of cards, someone knitting over there and someone reading a newspaper, and a new guy walk in or a new girl walk in. No one shakes their hand. It becomes a mausoleum. You know, and that's scary. Until one day maybe someone says, hey, who was that man? What was that experience they had? What was that message? What is this movement really, truly all about? Thanks.